Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Here's what the novel coronavirus is teaching us over and over and over again. Systems that are a marvel of efficiency might not be that resilient under unanticipated strain. Healthcare, the economy, and food. So today we're going to talk about the food supply chain, all the nodes along that chain that rely on hardworking people, and how the coronavirus could worm its way into cracks in that system that we don't usually see. We're going to explore the length of the food supply chain this hour, and Michael Pollan will join us a little later to help us do that. But first, let's start near the beginning of the supply chain for meat, specifically the world's largest pork processor. This week, Smithfield Foods announced that it's shutting down one of its biggest plants until further notice. The reason? Too many workers falling ill from the novel coronavirus. In fact, more than half the cases of COVID-19 in South Dakota are from this single Smithfield plant in Sioux Falls. That plant, by the way, turns out 5% of all the pork produced in the United States. So joining us from Vermilion, South Dakota is Jackie Hendry. She joins us via Skype. She's the education and healthcare reporter for South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and she's been covering the Smithfield outbreak. Jackie, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, can you give us the latest about how large is the outbreak at the Smithfield processing facility?
Right. Well, by latest count, as of yesterday's numbers, 438 Smithfield employees have tested positive for COVID-19, and also 107 close contacts of those people have also tested positive. So that accounts for about 44% of the state's total cases are just those Smithfield employees.
Wow. And so they shut the whole thing down. What was the process behind that? Did Smithfield want to close it down, or how was that decision made?
It was a combination. So last week really was when we started to really get an idea of just how large this outbreak at the plant was. And initially, Smithfield, once we crossed about 100 cases of employees, Smithfield offered to partially close down for about 3 days over this past weekend to sanitize the plant, add physical barriers between employees, and additional measures like that. However, over the weekend, as that number quickly crossed 200 and 300 cases, the mayor of Sioux Falls, Paul Tenhaken, drafted a letter to Smithfield asking them to close for at least 2 weeks. Our governor, Kristi Noem, also signed on to that letter. They submitted that on Saturday. And then by Easter Sunday, Ken Sullivan, the CEO of Smithfield, released that they would, in fact, close the plant indefinitely, it seems, and are able to pay the employees for at least the next 2 weeks.
Okay. Now, Paul Tenhaken, the mayor, as you just mentioned, I mean, he has been quoted as saying that this was not a decision that they took lightly. I mean, he noted specifically the impact on the food supply. I mean, how big is this plant?
It's very big. It's our number four employer in the city of Sioux Falls. They employ 3,700 people in the single plant, but it's also the go-to plant for distribution for our pork producers. So this particular Smithfield plant serves South Dakota, Minnesota, some farmers in Iowa, Nebraska, North Dakota. And we're hearing that some pork producers in South Dakota especially are now going to see a backlog of hogs on their operations because they have nowhere to send them. And then it turns into a problem of if you have nowhere to send your hogs, then those hogs keep gaining weight, they keep growing, they're going to surpass the weight that is best for them to sell to those processors. And then you've also got piglets and baby hogs that are going to need the space that those adult hogs are currently taking because they're not going to the processing plant. Worst case scenario, some of these hog farmers are going to be looking into potentially euthanizing their baby hogs just because there's nowhere else for them to go.
Wow. So potentially terrible outcome even before that pork reaches the processing facility. And then, I mean, as we noted, 5% of all the pork processed in the United States comes from this one location. So there's certainly going to be downstream effects as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. all throughout the supply chain, we're going to see effects. I know hog farmers have said they need about 9 to 10 months notice if a plant of this size is going to be closed. Of course, that's not the reality we're living in right now. And then downstream, this will hit grocery stores.
Okay. And so do we have a sense at this point in time, or maybe it's too early to know if and when Smithfield thinks it might be able to open? I mean, indefinitely is a long time.
Mm-hmm. These cases continue to rise, and it's too hard to say. I think, like in every other aspect of this pandemic, we're taking things day to day.
Okay. Well, Jackie Hendry, healthcare reporter at South Dakota Public Broadcasting, joining us from Vermilion, South Dakota. Jackie, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Okay. Well, let's turn now to Michael Pollan. He is, of course, a writer and journalist who's written many best-selling books about food, including The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, and In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. And he joins us today from Berkeley, California. Michael Pollan, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Meghna.
So,
good to be here.
It's great to have you. So first of all, just give us your thoughts on what the closing of the Smithfield plant and its impact on the pork supply, what that tells us about our food supply chain and the resilience of it as a whole.
Well, it speaks to its lack of resilience. It's an incredibly brittle system. It's efficient without doubt. But when you have 5% of the nation's pork supply, depending on a single factory, you have a very concentrated system. And it is not, you know, there's a trade-off between efficiency, which you can get at a large plant like that, and redundancy, which is a system that can withstand breakdowns at any one point. And, you know, imagine if we had a more decentralized, localized meat economy. This wouldn't even be a news story. But the fact that so much of the pork supply is passing through the walls of one plant is a vulnerability. And I think that COVID-19 is exposing all sorts of vulnerabilities in the food system.
Mm. Well, so that, like you said, that efficiency has allowed us to, you know, feed the United States and a lot of the of other countries in the world. But at the same time, I guess I'm wondering, it's really drawn our attention to, or the pandemic has drawn our attention to, how much the food supply chain really relies on workers, on people. That it's not that they are the weak points; it's that we can't operate this efficient supply chain without them.
No, it's not as automated as other parts of the economy. Something like 14% of the U.S. workforce is involved in the food system, whether they're servers in restaurants or meat cutters in slaughter plants or farmers or people harvesting our food. It's a labor-intensive system. But it also happens to be a system that depends on the least protected workers in our economy. Less than 7% of all food workers are covered by a union, for example. Very few food workers have paid sick leave. So, you know, we have this irony, which is becoming quite evident, that the people we deem essential at this moment happen to be the least protected workers. We don't treat them as if they're essential. And that's doubly true for food workers. Mm-hmm. Many of them are undocumented, too. Many of the, I don't know about the Sioux Falls plant, but many, many of the workers in meat plants, as we've seen through various raids and arrests over the years, are undocumented, so that when they get sick, they can't stay home, and when they go home, they're often living in very crowded homes, in trailers sometimes, so that the chances of transmission, whether they're at work working very close to one another, side by side cutting pork, or at home in crowded you know, houses or trailer camps, it's a recipe for a pandemic, mm-hmm. for contagion.
Mm-hmm. Well, and so I'm curious about, we'll come back to workers in a second because they are the heart of the story here. But I'm thinking about how the impacts of the closure of processing facilities like this, maybe we won't feel it today or tomorrow, but we're likely to feel it down the line. I mean, do you think we're going to see more of this in other processing facilities?
Yeah, I think the chances are we'll see it in processing facilities, but we'll also see it when it comes time to harvest our crops in the fall, when we depend on migrant workers to pick these crops. What happens if they can't get into the country? What happens if they're sick? No, I think we're going to see shocks. I'm sorry to say. You know, we have one taste of disruption in the food supply chain already, and that was the hoarding we saw at the beginning of the pandemic, which goes on in certain product categories, but in general is not as bad as it was on the evidence of my own supermarket. But that was a demand problem. That was the fact that there was suddenly too much demand for the amount of food in the pipeline. What's next, and what this Smithfield plant is a sign of, is a shift to a supply problem, and that we have the supply chain. We're all depending on it right now. While we're all at home, other people are out there making sure that, you know, the trucks are driven and the crops get picked and the meat gets cut. And so I think this is the problem we're going to be dealing with, the buckling of a very long and intricate supply chain that for most of us, most of the time, don't give a thought to.
Yeah. So help us think through what kind of time frame we need to be considering. What is the cycle that food is on? Are you looking to the fall right now?
I think we have to look at the whole year. Okay. I mean, right now we're planting. And planting is actually, at least in the Midwest, is the least labor intensive. A single farmer with a tractor can plant literally thousands of acres of corn or soy or wheat. In California right now, where our so-called specialty crops are grown, this is the kind of food you can actually eat. These crops are in the ground or being planted right now, and this is the tomatoes and the cucumbers and zucchini that you'll be getting this summer. And I don't know, I haven't heard any reports of what's going on in that population. Fortunately, California, where I live, has been less hard hit than many places. And we locked down first in the country, I believe.
Yeah. Michael, I'm just going to jump in here for a second because we do have to take a quick break. We are talking this hour with Michael Pollan and taking a look at the food supply chain from farm all the way to your grocery store and the vulnerabilities that the COVID-19 pandemic is revealing about that supply chain. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the vulnerabilities that the COVID-19 pandemic is revealing about the supply chain for food. And I'm joined today by Michael Pollan. He is a writer and journalist and author of many best-selling books about food, including The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. And On Point also spoke with Megan Konar. She is a professor of civil engineering at the University of Illinois who studies the food and water supplies. And she's mapped the flow of food across the country.
I think the food system really provides a great example, even though we hear a lot about how we live in divided times right now, that, you know, actually we are all reliant upon one another and deeply intertwined.
And Professor Konar also had this proposal to coordinate resources before the next shock to the food system occurs.
There are many agencies that consider important yet disparate components of our food system. So there's the U.S. Department of Agriculture that focuses on agricultural production and risk management, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration that ensures the safety of the food we eat, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency and other disaster managers that plan for bringing food supplies to local areas impacted by natural disasters. But surprisingly, there's no national agency that takes a holistic view of our national food supply chain, or one that plans for a widespread shock to our food system, such as the one that we're experiencing right now in the current pandemic. So I would just say that our food supply chain is critical for our national security, and I hope that it will be prioritized going forward.
That's Megan Konar from the University of Illinois. Michael Pollan, respond to what Megan was saying there, because it is fascinating that this is a critical, we need food to survive, to speak plainly. And yet, as she points out, there's all these disparate agencies that are in charge of different parts of the supply chain, and we don't take a holistic view of it.
It's a mess. It's absolutely a mess. You have the FDA is responsible for assuring the safety of produce, of plants, and the USDA is responsible for assuring the safety of meat. They don't talk to one another. Efforts to combine them under a single regulatory regime, which was proposed during the Obama years, was firmly rejected by the meat industry, who loved the fact that the USDA is in charge, because they're also responsible for promoting meat consumption. So they have a very conflicted role. But it is a very balkanized system. And the other thing to also keep in mind is we don't have one food chain. We have two big ones.
Right.
We have a food chain that delivers food to your supermarket. But then we have a very different food chain that delivers food to your office, your school. It's called food service. And that's about 50%. 50% of meals are eaten outside the home. And what's happened now, which is very weird, is that the food service food chain has basically stopped because we're not going to work. Mm-hmm. We're not going to restaurants. Mm-hmm. And all the food in it is not reaching people who might not want to eat it, because that food chain is so specialized. It sells eggs in 72 egg cartons. It sells milk by the, 5 or 10 gallons. So that food cannot simply be rechanneled to the grocery chain, with the result that huge quantities of food right now are being thrown out. Milk is being spilled on the ground and into the sewer. Apples and all sorts of fresh produce are being composted or just left in the field, because the system, again, with its efficiencies, has this brittleness. And we don't know quite how to move that food to a place where people
right.
can actually eat it.
Well, the terrible irony is that the efficiency not only produces that brittleness, but in this emergency, it's the efficiency that's causing all the waste. I mean, and they are that separate, these two systems, that we can't just quickly pivot and get that food into grocery stores. Because I'll be honest, I received a bunch of email from listeners over the past several days asking just that, like, why can't we turn this restaurant food into grocery
yeah.
food?
Well, in some cases, they're just different companies. So how do you marshal two different companies to communicate and do business with one another? I do think it's something that, had we had a government response to this pandemic and had things like the Defense Production Act been used in an effective way, or the Army Corps of Engineers. I mean, it seems to me that with a galvanized federal effort, these are problems you could solve. But we're dealing with this pandemic in the absence of a federal response, except a lot of bluster.
So where would you recommend that, if you had the ear of anyone in the Trump administration, where would you recommend they focus on to actually put some changes into effect over the course of the spring and summer?
Well, I think we have to start by protecting the workers.
Yeah.
If you want this system to have a little bit of give, a little bit of suppleness, you have to keep this this population healthy. And you do that by offering paid sick leave, by offering what the governor of Minnesota recently did, which is free childcare. And other states are considering this too. But we need a stronger social safety net for the people who are feeding us. If they're vulnerable, we're vulnerable. I think that's one of the great lessons of the pandemic, is that someone else you don't know's health may be vital to your own health. And that goes not only for, you know, social distancing and things like that, but for feeding ourselves. So I think that's the first step, is support the workers, give them what they need to do their job. Right now, you know, the CDC is busy weakening guidelines for food workers so that they can show up even if they're sick, if they're doing something essential. So actually, we're sending sick people back into plants like the Smithfield plant. And that obviously may get the food out the door today, but it's not a very good policy for tomorrow and next week and next month. Mm. So that's the first thing I do. And then the second thing I do is use the Defense Production Act and force some of these food companies to deal with one another, help them to figure out how to repackage milk and eggs and all these things into a form that it could enter the grocery chain. Or at the very least, go to food banks where it should be going before it gets thrown out.
I'm just casting my mind across the entire landscape of possibilities. Maybe even for places where like the distribution centers are that are holding all of this food that they can't send to restaurants, can people buy directly from those distribution centers? I mean, is that crazy?
No, it's not crazy at all. I think we have to think outside the box. And maybe you set up, a retail. I mean, it's interesting to watch how small business have responded. There's a restaurant in my town, famous restaurant, Chez Panisse, that is closed down. And what have they done with all the food coming to them, which is, produce from all over Northern California? Well, they've set up a CSA. And what's called community supported agriculture. And every week, customers who want can sign up online for a box of produce for $40. And you show up on Sunday and they've repackaged from several farms the produce that normally they'd be cooking. And we can come buy it, and people line up that one day. And so there's an example of a food chain that was redirected from an institution to individual consumers. So it can be done. But I think our food chain is so specialized that the people in that food service segment don't really know how to play the game in the grocery segment. And so that's not happening. Yeah. Now, maybe over time it will, of course. This problem is fairly new. Well, and hopefully we'll see some innovation.
To circle back to your point about how specialized the chains are, not just industrial or food service, but also grocery food. I'm thinking about, Jackie told us about the problem hog farmers are having because their hogs will be too big. I think a lot of people don't even realize, say for chicken, that there is a very narrow sort of a weight tolerance in terms of how they process chicken. So what's going to happen there?
Well, yeah, there's no market for 5 or 6 pound chickens.
Which is kind of amazing, right? That's kind of amazing.
It is. But that's what happens to a 3 pound chicken if you don't kill it. They get bigger. And I've seen these production lines, and chickens may be cut up by hand, but they're slaughtered automatically. They hang the chicken upside down on a conveyor belt it's one of those things that you see in car plants. And the chicken hangs down and a knife is carefully calibrated to slice the neck at a certain point. That system depends on every chicken in it being the exact same size. And that's a chicken that's, been slaughtered at 6 or 7 weeks. So what happens when that line shuts down? Well, you have to either slaughter all those chickens by hand, but then the machine that might cut the legs off or the breasts off can't handle a 5 pound chicken either. So you have a real problem there. And yeah, they're chicks now being, or eggs, fertile eggs that are being destroyed to stop putting so much chicken into that supply chain. Mm. So yeah, it's that level of precision and specificity that was such a blessing in producing abundant, cheap food that is precisely the most serious vulnerability in times that call for resilience.
You know, the engineering analogy of tight tolerances. I'm just thinking about how beautiful we think it is when like a gear spins just a couple of microns away from the housing that it's sitting in. But all it takes is a little piece of dirt that's just that size to stop the gears entirely.
Yes, and living things, obviously, are hard to conform to that kind
of
engineering precision. And we've done it, which is quite amazing. But right now, that system is failing. We're beginning to.
Well, Michael, yesterday we put the call out to On Point listeners who work at various points of the food supply chain to tell us what they're seeing. And we got a lot of responses. So here's listener Maida, who left us this message from Buffalo, New York.
I am an urban farmer in Buffalo, New York, and I'm definitely seeing a peaked interest among residents in Buffalo and Erie County to find more local produce. Just in the past week, calls have been popping up. How do we strengthen our local food systems? How do we connect consumers to local farmers? How can we support local farmers? And definitely, even though our restaurants have closed, still the chefs that are open doing takeout are still trying to support the farmers as much as they can.
That's Maida from Buffalo, New York. And we also got a message from Jeff, who's a truck driver. He left us this voicemail from the road.
The main problem I have is most truck drivers cannot find masks or anything, and we're pretty vulnerable. We do deliver to grocery stores. I got a load going to Costco now. The truck stops are pretty well supplied. They have little convenience stores in them. But they have no mask, and they limit how much water you can buy, and they limit several things. And all the restaurants are carry-out only. I was at a truck stop yesterday, had a Denny's in it, and the Denny's is shut down. And mostly available to us is fast food, which I don't really like to eat a lot of fast food. It's not healthy for me.
That's Jeff, a truck driver who called us from on the road. So, Michael, a couple of things there. One is, you know, Jeff was talking about he can't find masks. And this brings me back to you saying that food workers on any part of the system are essential workers. Are we seeing that problem elsewhere on the supply chain?
Yeah, the problem we have with PPEs, protective equipment, is acute in the food system. And we do need masks for people who are working in grocery stores, working in meat plants. Although we should point out that that's really about protecting them from, getting COVID-19. That you, as far as we know, the disease is not transmitted by eating things. So that if you, I mean, we should make sure people understand this, so that if you eat contaminated food, it appears that your digestive system will destroy it pretty effectively. So that the risk would be handling that food, which is, of course, what food workers do, and conveying it from one set of hands to another. But without question, that's what I mean by supporting the workers in the food system, that we have to think, how can we get them masks? How can we get them gloves? It's very important. And going to that first caller, I think she's right. I think that there is interest in local food systems, such as we haven't seen before, that there, if you want to find a system that is more resilient, it's a system in which there are thousands, tens of thousands of nodes that are producing your food, including your meat and your produce. And that kind of system might be more expensive in the short term, but in the longer term, it will withstand these shocks, so that if there is problem in, say, Sioux City, it doesn't necessarily ramify across the whole country.
Well, Michael, can I just jump in here? Because your point is well taken on that. But at the same time, I mean, this sort of mentally moves us further along the supply chain. There are these other sort of local nodes, but within a nation where, As we know, there are many food deserts, right? And where even on the best of days, the options are very limited, if not almost none. And so those local nodes aren't necessarily sort of equitably distributed across the country for people to quickly turn to when they need.
No, they're not all built. I mean, you know, that's what we've been engaged in for the last 15 years is rebuilding a robust local food system. And it's happening in many parts of the country. And it's happening in food deserts as well, where there are community gardens thriving. And farmers markets have been drawn into those neighborhoods by things like, you know, various programs, incentives, coupons distributed to people on food assistance. So, there's work to be done there. You don't find it everywhere. But it's growing, and I think it's going to get a huge boost under these circumstances. I think people will really appreciate keeping farmers in their community so they're not dependent on farmers 3,000 miles away.
We've got about 45 seconds before we have to take a break, but I just want to briefly ask you, we've been talking about domestic production of food, but of course, lots of food actually comes globally. There's a global supply chain here. Is that at risk of disruption?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, America still grows a lot of its own food. About 30%, I think, is imported, and that there will be disruptions there, I'm sure. But compared to a lot of other countries, we still are a breadbasket. So I guess that's something to be grateful for right now.
Well, so we are talking about vulnerabilities revealed by the COVID-19 pandemic in our food supply chain. We've talked about farms and workers there, processing facilities, a little bit about distribution and transportation. When we come back from the break, we'll talk about your grocery store. I'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we will be talking with former U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. She was also former governor of Kansas. So we're going to be getting a view from her on the current relationship between states and the federal government and what she's learned about crisis management, specifically about pandemics, from both angles. So we want to know what your question is for Secretary Sebelius about the federal response or how states are managing in the COVID-19 outbreak. And what are you experiencing where you are? So leave us a voicemail with your question for Kathleen Sebelius at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking with Michael Pollan. He's, of course, the famed food writer and journalist. And we are journeying through or along the food supply chain in the United States and trying to see where the vulnerabilities are in that supply chain that are being revealed by the COVID-19 pandemic. And the truth is that the vulnerabilities are where people are working because people are central to the successful delivery of food to your grocery store. For example, let's listen to listener Annie. She's an On Point listener who works at a grocery store chain in Michigan.
One of the biggest things we're seeing at the grocery store level when we talk about vulnerability with groceries is actually customers coming into the store and leaving wipes in the carts. So we see that like pretty much across the board. You know, we spend a lot of time, we've hired a lot of extra people to keep our conditions and sanitize everything, keep everything safe and clean. But we do see a lot of customers who either disregard their own waste in the store. We see that pretty frequently.
Annie also told us about shortages at the store where she works.
We're actually able to supply from a lot of our vendors who are working overtime every day, every week, trying to get stuff back on the shelves. But the demand is so high, especially for essential items. One thing we definitely see is WIC stamp items being taken or bought by people who don't necessarily need them. So that's something we're really trying to focus on with our customers, is making sure we're allowing people with food stamps to buy the food that they need and can buy with food stamps.
That's Annie, an On Point listener who works at a grocery store in Michigan. Michael, I'm going to ask you to hang on here for just a minute, because I now want to introduce into the conversation Bob Lebon Jr. He's president and CEO of Lebon's Markets, a supermarket chain with four locations in northwestern Connecticut. And he joins us from Woodbury, Connecticut. Bob, welcome to the program.
Hello, Magna and Michael.
So what's the past month been like for you?
Like nothing we've ever seen. Just like Christmas Eve, every day. It's like Groundhog Day. Every day you just are going nonstop, and it's just amazing. The response from our crew, they just continue to perform under, you know, really scary conditions, and that's the whole thing, is trying to keep them safe. That's my number one priority.
And what kind of things are you doing to help keep them safe? Because obviously it seems without the workers, you wouldn't have a store to operate.
Well, a month ago, we were one of the first stores to put up the plexiglass shields at the register, and we have since extended them so they're longer shields. Then the next week, we put up shower curtains, clear shower curtains on the backside, so that even the customers on the backside of them would have a barrier. I think it was the first store in the country to put up a 44-inch plastic clear shield over the entire deli counter, so that the deli counters wouldn't interact with the customers, or the meat counters where there's a service where you're actually getting waited on, and they would go to the end and hand the product at the end. We also started taking temperatures last Tuesday at all four locations. So before a customer comes in, we're asking to have their temperature taken. And so far we've had two people that have failed, and they were nice about it. And they said, oh, I didn't realize I had a fever. And then starting next Monday, we're going to require all customers to wear masks. If they don't have one, they can buy one for a dollar. If they're unemployed or not working, they can get it for free. So it just took a while to resource the mask. I would have started the temperature, you know, 2 weeks ago, but it took 2 weeks to get the thermometers, and then it's just a struggle trying to get the mask. So I'll have the mask in the next few days, and we'll start that on Monday.
Mm. And so it sounds like you're saying that the customers are reacting positively or supportively to you taking their temperatures before they come into the store.
I would say 98%. There's 2% that, you know, thinks it violates their rights, whether it be under ADA or HIPAA rules. Well, we don't know their name, age, date of birth. We're not recording these temperatures. It's strictly a 2-second test, and just trying to keep our people safe. I have 420 people working, and I want to keep them safe and their families, because they could potentially bring it home to their elder family members.
Right. So 420 people working for you in the four locations that you have. Help us understand the business here a little bit more, Mr. Lebon, because as you heard Michael say earlier, you know, in a sense, the food supply chain in the United States is a marvel of efficiency. So how many workers could fall sick? Not that we want any of them to at your stores, but like, what are the tolerances for your stores in terms of how many could you lose for a period of time before you'd have to shut down one of your stores?
Well, the next step would be, which we are already always considering, and if people do get sick, is we'll have to go to pickup only, which would really dramatically make it even more difficult. Three of my locations are the only traditional supermarket in town, so you cannot process 1,000 transactions. So it would be would put a lot of pressure on the other stores in town if they were able to stay open. I'm seeing it at my wholesaler now. They're having people get sick, and they're running 12-hour days, mandatory shifts to keep up with the demand. And now they're losing. Last Sunday, they lost 82 people at their plant, which processes thousands. So now the deliveries are becoming 24 to 36 to 48 hours later. So, and we're seeing it, you know, upstream where production plants now, whether it be for cereal or yogurts or other products, their people are getting sick. So now they're limiting so many items they can produce. So I think it's going to get much worse before it gets better.
Michael Pollan, did you have a question or a reflection based on what you were hearing from Bob?
No, only that I'm a big fan of his stores. We lived in the northwest corner of Connecticut for a long time and would often shop at Lavon's. But I think that the kinds of precautions he's taking are exactly what we need to see rolled out across the country, because that's far beyond what I'm seeing at my grocery store here in Berkeley.
Mm. Well, so Bob, let me turn back to what you were saying about the wholesalers and employees there getting sick. I mean, how many different wholesalers, how many different suppliers do you have? Typically?
Well, I would say major ones, about 20, but we get about 60% of all our product from one major wholesaler. That's for the grocery, frozen dairy, paper goods, meat, produce. And so that's the one that is really feeling the pinch. And there again, they're feeling it. Recently, this week's checklist is there's 1,000 items from their manufacturers that are now discontinued until further notice, because they can't keep up with production, or, again, they're being hurt by their production facilities with people calling out sick.
Mm. So a lot of reliance there on that one major wholesaler. What about sort of the typical inventory that you have? How often does that inventory turn over, and what's it like right now?
I'm probably running in my stores anywhere from 50 to 60% less than I normally would. And so what's happening is because the system has been pressurized, everyone is on allocations. And so if we normally would get in, say, 1,000 cases per delivery, we might be getting 500 or 400. So we're slowly declining every week as the sales continue to be strong because, again, as you said earlier, no one's eating in restaurants or schools. And so that is putting all the pressure on this one side of the system. The other 50% food service is basically extinct.
Extinct. For now, and it's still shocking to hear that. But Bob, let me also ask. So look down the line for us. Look into the future over the next couple of months, say through the spring and even the summer. What is it that you need to keep your stores going and serving your customers?
I need cooperation with the customers. Again, it's a small percentage of people that think what we're doing is overbearing and kind of government rule. My wife is an ICU nurse, so she's seen it firsthand of what this pandemic is doing to the patients and the death that it's causing. So I would rather err on the side of caution and just everyone try to be patient with us, because everyone is working so hard and it's only going to get harder, I think, as more people become sick or the supply chain gets stressed even more. So I think patience is the number one word I would ask everyone to maintain.
Yeah, patience from your customers. And what about from other agencies, from the government, from the people that you do business with, those wholesalers? What do you need to keep going?
Well, I think it's going to be just prioritizing. What is the priority? It's nice to have, maple berry tied, but maybe we just don't need to have. I think that's what's going to fall out, is people are going to realize we don't need to have that many choices. I started when I was 8 years old, and there was one kind of milk, whole milk, in quarts, gallons, and half gallons. Do we need to have, 200 varieties of milk now with all the different kinds and flavors and lights and lactose? And so I think less is more is what's going to be in the future.
Well, Bob Lebon is president and CEO of Lebon's Markets, a supermarket chain with 4 locations in northwestern Connecticut. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great day. Be safe.
You too. Michael, pick up on Bob's thought there that he sees the possibility of people rethinking sort of what they presume or what they're okay with even having in the grocery store.
Well, I think we're going to get an education. My impression going into grocery stores today is I feel like I'm in the Soviet Union, circa 1984. And, it's a thrill when you see your brand of milk or your, we've been drinking oat milk, and that's exactly what he's talking about, though. A proliferation of non-milk milks. And, it was a thrill. And, I'm tempted to call other people who haven't seen oat milk in the market or their brand of oat milk in the market. And so there are these, targets of opportunity in the store. And of course, everybody knows the thrill of finding a big pack of toilet paper now. I think we're going to adjust. It's the same thing as if you eat from a CSA box. That's not your choice. You're getting a box of what the farmers got, and then you work around it. You cook. You figure out what you're going to cook based on what shows up. And I think that we are going to have that sort of Soviet bloc training, to at least to some extent, as selection dwindles. And it probably will dwindle, I'm sorry to say.
So let's go back to the workers, right? Because the big lesson here is underscore the E in essential for workers in the food supply chain. Is it possible that right now, because people are beginning to realize this in a more intense way than they have before, that some of the changes that you called for earlier and how those workers are treated might actually come to pass?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that workers and their whatever organizations they have representing them have an opportunity here, and some of them are seizing it. There are workers and various groups insisting on paid sick leave. And you see companies like Amazon offering new benefits to their workers, raising salaries, hourly wages. Because this is a moment where the workers have leverage. The workers are indispensable, and the companies are willing to pay it. The interesting thing to watch is whether when the crisis passes, whenever that is there an effort to take away these benefits, lower wages again? I think that's hard to do. I think once you've given somebody paid sick leave, it's very hard to take it away. But we will see, I think, a real shot in the arm for efforts to organize food workers. And these have been underway for the last few years. I mean, not just, unionizing mm-hmm. farm workers, but restaurant workers and people at every link in the food chain. There's demands for paid sick leave, demands for a $15 minimum wage. And so this has been percolating for the last 10 years or so. And my guess is that gains will be made and that some of those gains will be lasting. I certainly hope so, because these vulnerabilities don't go away. They've been exposed and they are there. For me, I take some solace in the fact that Perhaps we will use this crisis to fix the vulnerabilities that have been exposed by it.
Hopefully. But I do wonder, in the pre-COVID-19 world, one of the benefits that many Americans enjoyed of this highly specialized, highly efficient supply chain for food was price. Price and choice. So do you think that there will be a tolerance for the American consumer after this if, in order to be more resilient, maybe we have to be a little less efficient and therefore also pay a little more?
And pay more. Well, cheap food is expensive. This is one of the lessons, that the blessings of cheap food come with these risks and these vulnerabilities. And so it's an illusion to think this food is cheap when it's produced on the back of somebody earning, less than the minimum wage, when it's produced by people who aren't safe. Is that really so cheap? We're paying the price right now for all that cheap food. So I would hope that people will come out of this as people who lived through communism in Europe did, with a real keen appreciation for food. And not take it for granted and realize what an incredible product this is, and how many hands it takes, how many species it takes to put these wonders on our plates, and that it is something worth spending the real price for.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 30 seconds left, Michael. I just got to ask, what are you cooking now?
We have been cooking like we've never cooked before. We have not had a single meal takeout in the last month. And so we're actually cracking open cookbooks that we haven't used before. I have to say, the dish I'm most excited by, and I encourage everybody to look it up, is a shallot pasta dish in the New York Times. I think it was about a month ago, which is shallots, tomato paste, and anchovies that you turn into a paste that you then mix pasta through. And it's absolutely delicious.
Well, Michael Pollan, he is the noted food writer and journalist, author of many best-selling books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. By the way, an audio version of Food Rules, an Eater's Manual, is out this week. And he joined us today from Berkeley, California. Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Meghna, always a pleasure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.